Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in once again. It's David Summers, and it's another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America, as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring, back into time, as we get wall-to-wall and tree-top tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Hey, Ron, I got to tell you, it seems like I say this a lot, but your last Studcast, number 348, was another record breaker. Your story about one card in the Memphis territory in Lexington, Kentucky, in May of 1979 was really fascinating, with all the drama behind it as a hidden history lesson about two territories. This episode should be just as interesting, if not more. You're going to be talking about a subject that was probably an even more hidden history lesson, because this one deals with the expansion of the Southeastern Gulf Coast territory and the very confidential sale.
Yep, that's right, Dave. And, you know, this is about as confidential a subject as it gets in the wrestling business. You start talking about the purchase of a single city, much less a part of a territory. So I'm going to pull back the kayfabe curtain, man, big time in this Studcast. We're going to start with the Southeastern Territory history from 1974 to 1980. Short, a bit. Listen to that. And that's going to take us to the Birmingham Purchase. And that's going to lead us to 1985, to Continental Championship Wrestling, CCW, and the next expansion. So we're going to talk about what was happening in my grandfather, Roy Welch's NWA Mid-American territory after his death, and why any of that territory was available for sale, and why it made sense for us to want it in Southeastern Gulf Coast down there, and how we were going to buy it. So then on the back half of this Studcast, we're going to get into the card of May the 6th, 1980 in Mobile, Alabama, and discuss where things were headed during this time frame. So, man, I see no reason, man, to delay to get this one started, Dave. So so before we finish today, I'm shooting to get to ourselves a learning tree question, if we can get that far. And we haven't been able to do that lately, but I'm going to make a real push to see if we can get there today.
Hey, I tell you what, I'm saddled up and ready. I hope the learning tree question happens. I think we can make that happen. So where do you want to begin in covering the Southeastern expansion in this Studcast?
Well, we don't. Why don't we start with going back to the beginning, man, of Southeastern wrestling itself. Take a little short ride here from 1974 to May of 1980. So in the fall of 1974, I bought John Kazana's city of Knoxville and a few surrounding nearby towns that he had operated only on weekends and I paid $150,000 over a 5-year period of time for it. Everyone thought I was crazy, man, when they heard that amount back in 1974. And if that had been my plan when I bought it, to just continue to do what he had been doing and only run on the weekends, they'd all been right. That would have been too much. But my plan was to expand it, that town, into over time, take it from being a town to a territory. And that's why, from my very first week as owner, on my very first TV show, I had them call the new company Southeastern Championship Wrestling, basically hoping it was going to get much bigger than just one city and a few towns around it. So luckily, I was able to make that happen. And within the first 18 months, by early 1976, we were operating six nights a week, like most territories. We were having matches in four states, Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia. In 1978, I bought the old Gulf Coast Territory, the one that my father had built between 1954 and 1959, and then he sold it to family members, Lee, Bobby, and Don Fields. They ran it until 1978, which was almost 20 years, and that's when I bought it from Lee Fields, who at that point, I think he had bought his brothers out, and he was the guy that owned it. So suddenly, after only four short years as an owner, Southeastern Wrestling had two territories, one obviously in Tennessee, the other one down there on the Gulf Coast. And so the only thing missing to link the two territories was basically Birmingham in the northern part of Alabama and Chattanooga, Tennessee, which was owned by my grandfather's Roy's company, Mid-American Wrestling. So in 1979, I experienced a war over the Knoxville Southeastern Territory that basically ruined that territory. And as a result, I sold it to the owners of the Georgia Territory, Jim Barnett and Fred Ward. By 1980, I was back to owning only the Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory by myself. For the first time since we bought the territory 2 years earlier, my four partners and I, we were going to be there and working together on that territory finally, but it took until 1980 before we were ever all going to be there and doing it at the same time. So just months into 1980, it was proving to be a really good decision to get us all there, to get rid of Knoxville and those problems up there. And we were having a record year in early 1980. By May, it was our third year there. And that brings us up to the date of May 6, 1980. That happens to be the date we're going to be discussing later in the studcast. Mm-hmm. The day we acted upon, and it was the day that we acted upon our plan to expand again. So this time, we were going to expand to our north. First time from Knoxville, I expanded to the south. We were going to expand to the north this time, and we were going to be looking at the Mid-American territory of my grandfather, Roy, and his partner, Nick Gulas.
Well, you know, that certainly tells the story from 1974 until May of 1980. What happened in the Mid-American territory that made you think that it was for sale?
Well, my grandfather, Roy, had retired in 1975, and Nick Gulas, his partner, for many years, took over running the territory. Nick was also getting up there in age at that time. He was an older guy, and he was having a big problem operating the territory without Roy, who had been his partner for 30 years. So it was a big adjustment to try to do this all by himself. So he was running weekly in Birmingham and Huntsville, Alabama. He was also running weekly in Nashville and Chattanooga, Tennessee, in the state of Tennessee. Plus, he was running multiple other small cities and towns. And on top of his territory going down, which it was, and it had been basically since Roy left it, he compounded that problem by pushing his son, George Gulas, to become his Mid-American champion, something that George Gulas was definitely not ready for and never would be. I mean, he just wasn't cut out for it. And it didn't take long for George basically to kill his father's territory. And all the fans knew George's father was Nick, and that fact made George Gulas a joke for him as champion. You know, I mean, it would have been, I think Nick would have lasted a lot longer had he not made George his champion. But he was such a bad wrestler that it just kind of killed his whole thing. So around 1979, things went very bad. They went from bad to worse for Nick, and he began trying to sell his territory. And he was looking for buyers for Nashville, Chattanooga, and Birmingham. And we were definitely not looking to expand in 1979. Heck, I was fighting a war in Knoxville, and we were struggling in Southeastern Gulf Coast, because Rob and a heck of a lot of our key talent down there in the Gulf Coast had headed to the Memphis territory. So, and we talked about that situation in the last studcast, based upon that big card in May of 1979 in Lexington, Kentucky. So we had a plate full of bad things that we didn't need to be trying to expand. And so it wasn't, I wasn't even aware Nick might have already sold Birmingham in 1979, but it was in such bad shape. I heard that he made a deal with some guys, but the deal had kind of fallen through between 1979 and into the early part of 1980. So in early May 1980, because we were doing so well in the Gulf Coast, I sat down with my partners and we started discussing expansion. And we talked about maybe buying Birmingham, not just Birmingham, but all of Northern Alabama from Nick. So everyone in the group, all of us were on board, and we wanted to make it happen as soon as possible. So on this Tuesday, May 6th, the same day that this Mobile card we're going to be talking about later in this studcast, on that same day, I got on a plane and flew to Nashville, and I made an offer to Nick Gulas for Birmingham and all of the northern part of Alabama for $75,000 cash.
Wow. Okay. Well, so what kind of a relationship did you have with Nick? I've heard you talk about him a lot of times before, but the kind of relationship you had with Nick Gulas, and what did he say to your offer?
Well, I was the only family member, Dave, that had actually practically no history with Nick. I had wrestled for Nick only four times in my life at that point, and all four of those matches were basically in 1972. And I had spent my early career in Georgia and the Florida territory. And these four matches that took place over only 2 days that I was there, wrestled four times, I only went there because I wanted to visit Rob. He had worked that territory, and that's where he had spent a lot of time, and Jimmy as well, working for Nick and Roy and over in Tennessee. And I had been in the South, way down in Florida there. So the first night that I went to visit Rob, I flew into Huntsville, Alabama, and we wrestled in front of about, I'm going to guess, maybe 500 people in Huntsville, Alabama. This was 1972. Me and Rob were in a tag match, and after the match, Nick came over to me, and I didn't even know him. I hardly knew him. I had only met him a few times, and the first thing he did was start yelling at me. And he said, boy, he called everybody boy. He said, boy, you don't have enough fire, man, in this match out there. And he said, you need to learn how to make a comeback. Well, gosh, the dressing room went dead silent. I mean, you know, I don't know how things usually went with Roy, but, you know, I guess they were waiting to see what I was going to do. They didn't know who I was. A lot of them weren't even aware of who I was much. So as soon as the dressing room went silent, Rob reached up to grab my arm and tried to stop me because he knew I was going to answer Nick. You know, so, but it was too late. So he wasn't my boss. You know, I didn't work for him. I was just there visiting Rob. So he got in my face and he yelled at me. So I got right back in his and I yelled right back at him. And I asked him, I said, do you know where I was last Friday night? And he said, no. And he kind of hung his head, you know. And I said, I was in St. Louis, Missouri, in Kiel Auditorium. I was in the main event with 10,000 people in the building against the former NWA world champion, Gene Koninsky.
Yeah, not a crowd of 500, a crowd of 10,000.
10,000.
Thank you. Exactly.
Yeah. And you're telling me I need to learn how to make a comeback.
Yeah, what's wrong with you, Ron? Come on.
So then I didn't stop at that, you know, and oh boy, everybody in the dressing room was looking at each other like, God, nobody talks to Nick like that. So I told him, I said, you need to mind your own business. I said, you never put on a rare pair of wrestling tights in your life. I said, you don't know a damn thing about how to have a match. And if you did, you know, I got in his face. I said, you know, if you ever say anything like this to me again, he goes, I said, you're liable to find yourself flat on your back, and you're liable to be carried out of this dressing room. And you could have heard pin drop in the dressing room.
God, I bet. Wow.
So Nick dropped his head, and he walked out of the dressing room. And, oh, boy, they buzzed in, man. Everybody's like, son of a gun. Wow. He tore into Nick. So Rob told me afterward, you know, he says, Rob, nobody ever talked to Nick like that. Not a single wrestler had anything to say on Nick's behalf.
Hell no.
In his defense, that's for sure. They could have jumped up and took his pot and pushed me away or done whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, so it was a little bit of a nasty situation my first time working for Nick.
Well, how tall was Nick versus you?
Oh, Nick was probably close to 6 feet. You know, Roy was 5'10". Yeah.
So he was
Nick
still
was probably about 6 feet.
Yeah.
But you know, maybe 150 pounds, and you know, he.
Yeah, I just envisioned this.
Nigger never dealt with anything like that before.
Yeah, this guy looking up at you when you're saying that wow, you went off on the owner of the territory like that, and nobody came to the defense of their promoter and owner of the territory. All right, I guess you would have to say your relationship was a little touchy. So what did he have to say about your offer 8 years after that day in Huntsville? That's interesting.
Well, he naturally wanted more money, you know, and he said, now $75,000 might be enough for Birmingham by itself, he says, but there's a whole lot of very good cities in the northern part of that state, you know, like Huntsville, the same town I had worked in 8 years ago for him. You know, and he said, there are a lot of great venues in this state. And he said, you know, I heard you guys are doing great down there on the Gulf Coast. And I'm happy to hear that. But then he reminded me, he said, you know, I know you paid $150,000 for Knoxville. For just that one city by itself. And he goes, and he said, but you've only offered me half that much for Birmingham and all the rest of the state of northern Alabama. So, so we were about to have another one of those confrontations. So I told him, you know, mm-hmm. I said, I'm aware, you know, how dead Birmingham is. Because, and, you know, and I said, and if it was drawing as poorly as I hear it is, then all the other little great venues, as you call them, like Huntsville, they're going to be just as dead as Birmingham. And I reminded him that I'd been to Huntsville before. And I said, I'm sure you remember that. Right? I brought it to his attention, the little deal we had 8 years earlier. And I reminded him that after buying Knoxville, since he brought that up, I said, I was able to turn that around. From being one city, Nick, into a whole territory. And I made a lot of money there doing it. And then finally I said, you know, and yeah, you know, this is a truly great offer. And not only that, Nick, it's cash.
Wow. Okay.
Basically, because he was having a real problem with cash at that point.
Yeah, and this was what year?
This was 1980. This
1980.
Was the same day that we're running Mobile that night.
You're offering him $75,000 cash in 1980. All right, so what did he say to that?
Well, you know, I didn't wait on the response. I got up. I figured this ain't going to work. So I headed for the door. In fact, I had the door open. I was already leaving the office. And, mm-hmm. and he screamed and he said, hey, Ron, come back here. He goes, you know, so I went back and he said, you know, I didn't intend to make you mad. He said, you kind of reminded me of your granddaddy, Roy. I guess Roy had got on him a few times. And he said, I know he'd be really proud of me, Ron, you know, and he says, because I'm thinking about your offer here. And he goes, this makes me feel good because you and your brother and Jimmy, you're all down there together and your granddaddy, you know, was my partner. And he goes, I'm going to take your cash offer.
Wow. Okay, so I have to ask this last question, especially after taking his taking your offer. Why were you not interested in Chattanooga and Nashville? They were both only really about 150 miles north of Birmingham.
That's a good question, right? I mean, we're buying Birmingham for $75,000, right? So, and they were both in trouble too. And so, but the problem was they were about 400 miles north of Pensacola, where all of our wrestlers live. Where we all live was down there on the Gulf Coast. And that meant that if I had bought those two towns, they would have been another 3 hours further drive than getting up to Birmingham. Already took 4 hours to get to Birmingham. You're talking about a 7 hour drive from Pensacola to either Nashville or to Chattanooga. So, so I found out a pretty important fact too, man, while running that my first territory in Knoxville, that the shorter the trips were, the better your wrestlers liked it. And that meant the better your wrestlers were going to wrestle for you when they got there. You know, that's a lot of big territories had great talent, but they had a hard time keeping them because their trips were so long, like the Mid-American territory, Mid-Atlantic territory. So to me, any trip further than 250 miles one way, that was going to affect the quality of the wrestlers you were going to get. You couldn't get top stars if you weren't going to, you couldn't be successful if you didn't have top wrestlers. So it was critical to keep that reputation as a short trip territory to ensure the company was going to be able to get the very best talent.
Wow. All right. And plus, I mean, that keeps your guys from having to drive 500 miles one way.
Yes. Yeah. One way, you know, 1,000 mile trip. I mean, to that 800 mile trip. Wow. That's horrible. Wow. And if you're doing that two or three times a week,
And
changes everything.
Yeah, of course, I imagine it does. And it seems like $75,000 was a great deal for you and your company. How did that come out?
Well, it certainly was, man. And I've done my homework before I went there. You know, I had paid $150,000 for Knoxville in 1974, and I sold it for that same amount in the fall of 1979, which was right before 1980. And Knoxville's population, Dave, in 1980 was 285,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
We bought Birmingham and all of northern Alabama for only $75,000. Birmingham's population alone in 1980 was 600,000 people.
Wow.
Twice as big as Knoxville.
Yeah.
And we paid $75,000 for a city twice the size of Knoxville and the rest of the, and the several other 100,000 population cities in the northern part of that state.
Yeah.
It's a heck of a buy. It's a tremendous deal. So in 1985, with Continental Championship Wrestling, we were going to expand again. So we were going to run from 1980 all the way into 85. We were going to change the name of the company to the Southeast from Southeastern to Continental Championship Wrestling. We were going to, for the first time, to be airing a show and taping a show in a major arena right there in Boutwell Auditorium in Birmingham. And we were ready to expand again. We went back to Knoxville. And also in 85, we picked up the city of Chattanooga. And we didn't pay a penny for either one of them because nobody was in Knoxville. It was dead. Chattanooga was not doing good. And so basically we went there. And so then we finally could go back and claim in 1985 the same thing that we could claim in 1978, that we were running towns from the Gulf Coast almost into the state of Ohio. And by 1985, once we went back to Knoxville and Chattanooga, we were selling out every one of those buildings every time we went north.
Wow. I'll tell you, this has really been a truly amazing story, Stud. An extremely interesting way to begin this Studcast. It is another great hidden history lesson. All right, before we take our break, set us up on the card. Let's go to Mobile, Alabama, running on the same day as you made the deal for Birmingham and Northern Alabama.
Yeah, so I flew from Nashville, been to Mobile, and you know, and I had some good news from my partners. We had got the town. He had taken the deal, you know, and this card was going to be in Mobile's Expo Hall, and the date was May the 6th, 1980. Pretty unforgettable to have a great match that night, a great card that night, and at the same time have made that deal in the morning. So the first match on the card that night was Roy Lee Welch against the fabulous Don Fargo. Then there was a return match that had ended up in a 20-minute time limit draw the week before. Same two guys coming back against each other. It was that really popular man, kid from Mobile itself and grown up there, Ricky Fields, son of Lee Fields, against the Big C. And the Big C had couldn't beat him in 20 minutes. So this is a no time limit match. So there was a special challenge tag match, which was going to be involving four of the wrestlers on the last card. Charlie Cook and Eddie Boulder were going to be facing their rivals, Randy Rose and Norvell Austin. And then for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship, Tony Charles was going to be defending for the first time ever against Dick Steinborn. Two great wrestlers in that match right there. Steinborn was a tremendous wrestler too. The Southeastern tag title was at stake, and it was a no disqualification match on this week. The champions, Ron Bass and Dr. Bill Irwin, managed by Big C, was defending against former champs Rob and I. Mm-hmm. And then there was a Southeastern belt also on the up for grabs, and a no time limit match since the last match they had the week before, Mongolian Stomper against Bob Armstrong, went to a 45-minute time limit. Wow. So this time was a no time limit match. And the new champion, Bob Armstrong, he was defending the title for the second time, only the second time, against the former champion, Mongolian Stomper, managed by the Big C.
Okay, I tell you what, that's another great card. And when we return after the break, we're going to be talking about the TV show that promoted that card, that set it all up. That will be when we come back on this Studcast. Okay, Studcast fans, Ron has been doing these Studcasts for more than 6 years. Some episodes are special numbers to reach. That is what the next Studcast is, a very special number, 350. It's also going to be special for him because of its subject matter. In the next Studcast, Southeastern had just purchased its largest city ever, Birmingham, Alabama, and will be revealing the special plans for bringing it back to life so far as wrestling was concerned there. None of this would have been possible without you, the listeners, and he will be saying some special words to those out there that make all this possible. Please join us next week. It's going to be really special. All right, welcome back in another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. I'm David Summers. Welcome in. This one is called, this is number 349, episode number 349, if you can believe that. It's called By Birmingham, Rob and I, Champs Again. All right, here we go. So Southeastern had been having some great TV shows in the past few weeks. How are you going to follow those in this Studcast?
Well, Rob and I, we'd been making those TVs more difficult to follow each week, to be honest with you. We were right. There were a great run of great TVs at that point. And this TV was going to be completely different than the last 2 weeks. And it was also the first week of May, which is TV rating month, man. So this TV is going to have two tag matches in it. It was going to have two champions on it. And one of them, Bob Armstrong, was going to be defending his Southeastern belt on TV, first week of the rating period. So it opened with the Big C and his Southeastern tag champions, Ron Bass and Dr. Bill Irwin, at the set with Charlie Platt. And they were going to watch the championship match from Mobile the week before against Robert and I. That was going to be hard for the Big C to explain what he was going to be watching. So the video started with Rob and I after a hot tag. Both of us were in the ring. We're making a big comeback on Bass and Irwin. And I'd knocked Bass through the ropes and out onto the concrete and was leaving the ring when Rob basically pinned Irwin right in the middle of the ring. this match was over, man. We were about to get our belts back, and all of a sudden, Big C, he just crawled right up into the ring, went straight to the referee, who was down on his stomach. He just went straight to him and stomped him in the back, you know. And he's watching that with Charlie. They're both watching this on the video. So Charlie asked him, you know, he says, what did you go in there for if you didn't go in there to save your team from losing? Pretty obvious what you went in there for. And Big C said, oh, no, you're all wrong about that, Charlie. He says, I went in there to tell the referee that Robert Fuller had used a foreign object on my man there. And that's why he knocked him out and why he was down and had him covered. And he said, I went in there to stop the referee, to keep him from making a big mistake and counting out the wrong man. So the video then showed the referee on his stomach, and that's where he showed Big C stomp him in the back. And then so Charlie asked him, well, why did that happen then? You know, why'd you do that if you're going to just tell him something? And he said, well, I accidentally tripped. And he said, and I fell on top of him. You know, it looked like I stomped him, but I accidentally tripped and I fell on top of the referee. And he said he wanted to explain. He said, I only wanted to explain, what Robert Fuller had done illegally. And then the TV studio, they had heard enough of that. They just started booing him like crazy. So, and he, as always, screamed at him to shut up, you know, and that didn't help. It got even more boos. So then Bass in the video came back in the ring, and I went after him. I put the Fuller leg lock on him. So when the referee finally got back on his feet after being stomped in the back, he came to me. I had to hold on Bass, and he patted me on the shoulder and let him go. Well, I thought we'd won, you know, and then he rang the bell, and then he went over and they had him announce that he disqualified Bass and Irwin for outside interference from the Big C. Who else, right? So Big C, he's still at the set. He instantly started protesting that he had accidentally fell on the referee, you know, and he said, my last thought, Charlie, was to get this tremendous team disqualified that I had, because he said they were headed for a clean-cut victory there. You could see it, right? So he turned everything around, so it had his view on it rather than anybody else's. And again, the studio audience, they let me know what they thought about it. So Charlie said that wasn't going to happen in the return match. He said, that's not going to happen again. You got another match with him because it's a no disqualification this next time. So the Big C, he thanked Charlie, and he thanked Southeastern for doing that, for making it a no DQ match, you know. And he says to Charlie, he said, the last thing he wanted to see was the Fuller boys not be getting their fair chance to get their belts back. And he thanked Charlie for allowing him to explain this situation. And the three of them went to the dressing room.
Remind me, what the Big C, did he wear as the Big C? Did he wear a black mask with his, I guess you would say, white locks hanging down from those?
No, I think he wore a white mask.
Okay.
To be honest with you, but he still had the blonde locks hanging down.
Yes, the bleach blonde locks.
Yeah.
Exactly.
He's talking about his good friend.
Yeah.
The Don Carson.
Yeah, of course. All right, so that sounded just like I would have expected. I'm sure the studio audience let him and his team know how they felt as they left the set. So who is in the first TV match?
Well, the studio audience was on it, man. He had cracked them up good early on. So Rob and I, when we got introduced, we were in this first match. We hadn't been on match. We had not had a match for 2 months on television. And wow, we got a tremendous ovation from the fans that were in the studio. And so we let the studio and the fans at home know that we appreciated it, and we end up beating both those guys with Fuller leg locks. So the second TV segment opened up with Dick Steinborn at the set. And he watched a video of his victory over Don Fargo the week before that earned him his first ever shot at the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, Tony Charles. And he turned down Charlie's invite to stay with him at the set to watch Charles, because he was going to be the opponent in the next match, in the next TV match. So Steinborn told him, you know, he said, Charlie, I've been studying Tony Charles matches for months now. And he said, and after finally getting that idiot Don Fargo behind me and out of my way, he said, I'm totally prepared to be the next junior heavyweight champion, and I'm going to win that belt in Southeastern Wrestling next week. So as Charles was being introduced to roaring applause from the studio audience, Don Fargo wasn't too proud to take Steinborn's place. Steinborn went to the dressing room, but Don Fargo went right out and sat down with Charlie, uninvited, you know. And so Tony Charles showed once again his legendary ability in the ring. Gosh, Tony Charles was such a tremendous wrestler. Fargo had a lot to say during this match about Tony and Dick Steinborn. And when Tony finished his opponent off, they did use another one of those spectacular throws that he was famous for. He did all those English maneuvers that were beautiful. Fargo ended with a little threat, a little threat-like comment of his own at the end of this, after Charles gets the win, and he made a threat. He said, something about Southeastern, Charles and Steinborn. He said, they're all going to regret their disrespect for me. They haven't respected me. They're going to regret it. That's how it ended.
Yeah, Don Fargo was a little bit crazy. So I'm not sure exactly what he meant by that last comment, but it would have scared me. That's for sure. All right. So who was on the personality profile for this studcast?
Well, it was the Big C and his former, Southeastern champion, the Mongolian Stomper. And Stomper was, again, standing behind him at the set. It was Charlie and the Big C sitting down. And Stomper had that big old huge truck shock, and he was cranking that thing. He was sweating like he'd been cranking it for hours. Charlie and Big C watched that last 3 minutes of the 45-minute time limit draw match, championship match, between Armstrong and Stomper from the week before. And after 45 minutes, the 5,000-plus Expo Hall fans in Mobile, they were raising the roof. They were just going to watch. They're watching the last 3 minutes. And the timekeeper's calling off those 3 minutes. 3 minutes to go, 2 minutes to go, 1 minute to go. That building was electric. And this was, in my opinion, two of the greatest athletes in the world. At this point, Stomper and Bob Armstrong going at it. And they were going to be coming back in a no time limit for a title match. So Big C bragged about the great Don Carson Stomper being now his property, because Southeastern Wrestling and the commissioner, Don Curtis, had seen fit 2 weeks ago to send Don Carson packing out of this part of the country. And that he was in constant contact with the great Don Carson. And in this upcoming hour title match with the now champion Bob Armstrong, they were going to see to it that belt would get back around the Stomper's waist where it belonged. So Charlie picked up on that last line, and he asked Big C, who is the they that you spoke of that's going to make sure that the Stomper gets the belt back on him next week. And so Big C told him, he said, mind your own business. He said, you being a meaningless morning personality on this redneck TV station, or Don Carson might just show up here to get you. You know, Charlie, man, he was usually really good at handling most anything wrestlers had to say to him.
Right.
But this was crossing the line, and Big C knew it, you know. So Charlie got red in the face, and he said, this is the end of our personality profile today. And he said, I will not be doing another one of these with you until you apologize to me and my fans out there. And maybe not even then. He just got up and left the set. The studio audience popped, So Big C, he's still sitting there, and And he's there screaming, "Come back! Come back here, Charlie Platt!" You know, and so the Mongolian stomper had been cranking that chuck shock. He just dropped the shock in the floor. He's looking down at the Big C like, what did you do, man? What's going on here?
Wow. All right, was this for real? I mean, he really said that to Charlie?
Yeah. He certainly did, you know. But it wasn't, I don't think it was intentional, because after the show was over, he went straight to apologize to Charlie immediately after the show. But wow, that got so much heat, you know. Rob and I, you know, we said, well, we're going to take advantage of this for a little bit, you know. And so actually, I thought Big C got more heat doing that than he could have gotten against any wrestler, no matter what he did. It really was something out of the clear blue that really got heat on him.
All right. So I'm sorry, but I missed that TV show. I wish I'd seen that. I saw so many of the TV shows that you're talking about. I never knew this happened. This must have been almost as big a deal as Bob Armstrong when he was a heel slapping Charlie Platt on TV in 1983. Charlie does not stop talking about that.
Oh yeah, I mean this incident is the only thing that's anywhere close to when actually Bob slapped Charlie in 1983 on the set. You know, this is about the only thing that could have been bigger than this incident. So back to the TV show. Let's go to, and this TV show was on May the 3rd. We're talking about in the third segment of the show, and he's already Charlie's already been upset here at this point, and so Eddie Boulder and Charlie Cook had joined Charlie at the set for this next segment, and they watched the end of a Texas Death Match from the week before, where Eddie Boulder was against Randy Rose. Norvell and Charlie Cook had just wrestled in the match before. And Norvell had won the match. It was a headbutt match. He ended up winning the headbutt match against Charlie Cook. So now Boulder and Rose are wrestling. And so Norvell is watching the match, and he sees that Rose is about to lose this match. And he goes down there and pounds the apron and gets involved in it, trying to keep Rose from losing. And so Charlie Cook sees what's going on. He goes down there and gets in Boulder's corner, and he starts cheering on Boulder. That building was pretty electric on this match, too. So then Cook and Austin, they both end up getting in the ring before the match was ever over and fighting again themselves. And the referee had to stop the Texas Death Match because there's another fight going on in the ring between Boulder and Rose. So before it was over, and in the past 2 weeks, these four wrestlers have been wrestling against each other. And so in this upcoming week, they were going to be, for the first time ever, in a tag match against each other.
Okay, gotcha. All right, so how about the next TV match?
Well, Norvell Austin and Randy Rose was in that one. And Boulder and Cook, they stayed at the set with Charlie to commentate over the match. And Austin and Rose, those two guys made a very good team, and Rob and I were back in the dressing room watching this. We'd never seen them wrestle together before, and we were impressed too. Like, son of a gun, these guys are good. And Boulder and Cook, they said the same thing. They were impressed too. So Austin and Rose, they ended the TV match. Rose used his clothesline, and Austin used his flying headbutt, and wow, it was a great win for those boys. And it was looking like this tag match was probably going to be one that would really rock the next week.
All right, so what about the last match of the TV show?
Well, that was the new Southeastern champion, Bob Armstrong, and he was defending his belt on TV in the first of four title matches on TV that's going to come in this rating month of May. And he had also had a very impressive opponent in this match. We didn't just let him wrestle some flunky. He wrestled Big Bill Dromo, about a 300-pound guy, a pretty darn good wrestler. And as soon as the match started, the Big C and the Mongolian Stomper came out of the dressing room, which is right there by the ring. And the Mongolian Stomper had that big old truck shock with him, and he just went about 2 feet off of the apron of the ring and stood right there pumping that thing while Bob Armstrong's trying to have a match, you know. And so it obviously made it difficult for Bob to focus on his opponent, and his opponent was no slouch. And this is for the championship. So as the match continued, Dromo was holding his own against Bob until the end. And then once Bob took over, man, you could see he was about to end this. And so he fired Dromo, kind of got him stopped a little bit. He fired him in the ropes, and Dromo dropped down. Bob jumped over him, and on the way back, when Dromo stood up, Bob hit him with one of those cross body blocks that he was really good at. Took the big man down, and he got the pin. So as soon as he got the pin, the studio crowd exploded, obviously, and Bob was getting his hand raised. And so the Stomper just dropped the truck shot, and Bob happened to have his back turned to where Stomper was, and Stomper jumped up on the apron behind Bob. Well, the studio crowd, they let Bob know he was there, man. They were screaming, "Lawyer!" And when Bob turned around, the Stomper took a wild swing at him. Bob ducked it. Stomper missed, and he swung around backwards till he had his back to Bob. Bob just reached over the top rope and popped the sleeper on him, man. Uh-huh. Right there on the apron.
Wow.
Right? And there's Carson, there's the big C standing down there on the floor, So Dromo saw what was happening as soon as he got up. So he came running across the ring. He was going to hit Bob with a knee in the back. He jumped high in the air, man. Bob saw him coming. He moved out of the way, and Dromo hit Stomper in the back. That threw Stomper off the apron. He landed on Big C out on the floor, and there was another big pop. So Bob pulled. He rolled out of the ring, which is pretty smart. He's got three guys out there now, and they're pretty bad. And he took his belt, was handed to him by the referee, and he didn't go to the dressing room. He went the opposite way, and he ran up into the bleachers and sat down with his fans, man.
It sounds exactly like Bob. God rest his soul. Wow. All right, so what a great ending to the TV. I mean, that was really cool. All right, so what happened in Mobile 3 days later? Let's go to May 6, 1980, Stud.
Well, Don Fargo won his match over Roy Lee Welch. The Big C increased his heat even beyond what he got when he insulted Charlie on the TV show. And he did it by taking advantage of that very popular smaller guy, Ricky Fields, in this no time limit match he had with him. And he managed to, behind the referee's back, load his glove, and he knocked poor Ricky out, man. And then he didn't cover him. He just stood over top of him, put his foot in his chest. The referee counted him out. And then a couple of wrestlers had to go and carry him back to the dressing room, Ricky. Big C was getting himself some good heat. In a special tag match between Charlie Cook and Eddie Boulder against Norval Austin and Randy Rose, Rose got a win over Charlie Cook. Then they had the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match. This match was a classic. Wow, it was so good. Steinborn and Charles were just amazing, man. Both of those guys were tremendous wrestlers. But true to his threat that he had made on TV and that little interview where he sat down there and talked during Tony Charles's match, and he kind of said, I'm going to get some respect, basically. Don Fargo, standing back there watching toward the end of this match, man, people in the building were loving it. He just picked his spot. He went straight to the ring. He put on his brass knucks, and he went in the ring, and he left both Steinborn and Tony Charles bleeding. The referee had to stop the match, right? He just went and popped both of them and went back to the dressing room. So it was going to lead to a very unusual three-way championship match the following week. The winner was going to be having to beat both opponents back-to-back before becoming a champion. That three-way match is going to be for the U.S. Junior Heavyweight Championship. Then Rob and I, we regained our Southeastern Tag Team Championship belts. And this time, Big C got involved again. He's managing not just the Stomper now, but the other, the Bass and Irwin, his tag team champions. Mm-hmm. And he accidentally hit Bill Irwin instead of Rob with his loaded glove, and he cost his teams their titles.
Wow.
So Rob and I, you know, so in the last match was a no time limit for the Southeastern Championship. Big C was again involved in the match. He seemed to be involved in every time he went there, he did something. So Bob Armstrong had the Stomper bleeding, and it appeared he was on his way to a fairly easy victory. And that's when the Stomper and Bob, they had a double knockout. Stomper went flying backwards, and he hit the referee, and the referee really went down hard. Referee got hurt worse than any of the three. The Big C came into the ring. He stood up over top of Bob, who was trying to get up, and he loaded his glove. Taking his time, he's going to get it done again. And when he took a swing at Bob, Bob ducked it, and he knocked Big C on his butt, and he took his glove off. And boy, the building was going crazy at that point. Stomper still down, and he was trying to put the glove on. Bob was trying to get the glove on his hand. He was going to load his glove and hit him with his own glove. And along came Ron Bass, and he brought with him is a bull rope, man. And he came to take care of business. And so as soon as he got there, Bob, he went right in the ring behind Bob. Bob never saw him coming. He took that bell and he hit Bob in the back of the head with it. Bob went down. And so Bass put Stomper on top of Bob. He grabbed the Big C's glove and he helped the Big C back to the dressing room. And referee finally got up. He counted out the champion, and Mongolian Stomper was back being the Southeastern champion.
Wow. Okay. That's a crazy match right there. All right. I'll bet that Expo Hall crowd was not happy with that at all. You and Robert won the belts, but Bob lost his. So how about the attendances for this card?
Well, Montgomery was up about 100 people. It was up to 4,300. Dothan was up about 200. From what it had been to 46, and Mobile was up about 200, 5,300. So still really, really good showing for those three cities.
Absolutely. Sounds great. Okay. I'm sorry. We're not going to have, no, I'm kidding. We are going to have time. We've got enough time for a learning tree question, stud. All right. So David Horowitz, Panama City, Florida says, when the Georgia Jawjacker disappeared for Southeastern, when was the next time Bob Armstrong wore a mask?
Whoa, that's a very good question. Wow. I may take me a second or two to figure this one out, David. So I got to piece some things together here. I may have to include some of my matches to get all that done. So let's go back to Bob Armstrong, who I'm going to say, the alias Georgia Jawjacker, Bob Armstrong. The Jawjacker had been in both Southeastern territories, not just down there on the Gulf Coast, but before that, he was in Knoxville. And the Jawjacker disappeared forever, 1980. Bob didn't wear a mask for a long time after that. I know he didn't wear them wear a mask in 1981. He didn't wear a mask in 1982. And I remember the last part of 1982 very well, because that's where he turned heel on me when he was refereeing that match between Flair and I for the world title.
Mm-hmm.
1983, he was a heel for almost the entire year. And I know he didn't wear a mask during that time frame either.
Right.
I think in 1984, while he was wrestling in Georgia, that's when he had that accident in the gym in Ohio, and he about tore his face off, man, with the bench turned over on him. Had a lot of weights on it, and he dropped weights in his face, and I know he didn't wear a mask after that happened to him, but I know he felt like he needed to wear one. Oh, it really disfigured his face.
How long was he out? Was he out for a period of time?
Oh, yeah. He was out for a long time, months. Wow. And months.
Oh, my
months
God.
Months and months. Mm. And in 1984, I had been a baby face. When we started down there, Bob was a baby face. I was the heel in 1978. And then I turned to baby face toward the end of 78. And I had been baby face from all the way up to this was 1984. And I remember I was having problems with Arn Anderson and Jerry Stubbs. They were the Southeastern Tag Champions. Nobody could beat them. And I was bringing in people and trying to get somebody that could help me take those belts away from those guys. And I kept trying to find the right partner. And then Bob was recovering finally from his horrible accident. And he was getting back in shape again. And he made a big push to be my partner. But I couldn't forgive him, man, from what he did to me in the Flair match back in 1982, 2 years earlier. I wasn't ready to let go of it. And I told him no. And so then I finally did, accepted him as a partner. And we got with Arn and Stubbs, wrestling them in a championship match. And I really wasn't over Dave, and I couldn't help myself. I had to get even with poor Bob. And me and Arn and Stubbs did a job on him, man. And he had just getting off of coming back from that face injury, and it was a really bad thing. And after that, I started my stud stable. That's when I became the greatest manager of all time.
Of course, of course.
I was really a bad, pretty nasty person. Wow. 1984, 1985.
Yeah.
So I think it was in the summer of 1985 when Jimmy Golden, who was one of the guys in my stable at that point, we were trying to get rid of Bob. All of my guys were trying to get rid of Bob. We had all the belts. I had all the titles except for Bob's belt. And so we were trying to get Bob out of Southeastern. And it was just about the time Southeastern became Continental. We started doing the show from Birmingham. So me and Jimmy came up with this idea of challenging Bob. And, we challenged him to a loser leaves tag match in a cage. And the deal was that he could pick any partner in the world to be on his team. And this was going to be a loser leave match. But if the two guys on Bob's team, only the loser had to leave. The guy that didn't lose could stay. So if he, let's say he took the Giant and the Giant got beat, the Giant would have to leave and Bob would have to stay. But if either me or Jimmy lost this match, we both had to leave. So this big duty, big heavy duty match. And he chose of all people, but he chose my brother to be his partner. Because Rob had never been a heel before at this point. And Rob and a lot of people didn't know this, but Rob and Bob were the Georgia Tag Team Champions back in the early 70s for a long, long time, unbeatable. And Bob had a lot of respect for Rob and he trusted him, you know. And Rob had never been never been a heel before. And then Bob also knew that if he got Rob to wrestle against me and Jimmy, that was not going to, he knew that would be the last person we'd want to wrestle as a family member. So the bottom line basically is he took Rob for the partner and Rob turned on him with me and Jimmy that night in the cage, Birmingham. So I don't know how many thousands of people were turned away from that night. That didn't get in to see it, but we turned on him and we beat Bob. Rob's partner was was Bob's. So Bob was the guy that lost his team for his team, and he had to leave. He had to leave Continental. At that point, it was Continental Wrestling. Mm-hmm. Had to leave Continental Wrestling for good.
Wow.
And so it was at that point that Bob put on that mask. The next time Bob wore a mask, and I'm pretty sure about this, that this is true, Bob became the Bullet, man. And he wore that mask, Dave, the rest of his career.
Yes, he did. He sure did. Wow.
And I can still hear Bad to the Bone.
Yep.
Every time I do, I think of Bob, man, which is quite often. Bob's one of the best friends I ever had.
And the strut down the aisle begins and the crowd goes freaking crazy.
Right, man.
Wow.
So thanks for your question, man, Mr. Horowitz. This has been a nice little reminisce for me, man, this one. So that's a great question. And I'm pretty sure that that's pretty accurate.
It's amazing to me what you and Bob and Robin, well, what you and Bob went through in the ring over the years and maintained the friendship that you did. And you were great, great friends. Wow.
Amazing. Yeah. Bob was a tremendous man. Oh, wow. I can't say enough about him, man. And we all miss him.
Absolutely. All right. Listen, I don't have to tell anybody. Another great one, Ron. So much history in this one of every kind. This has taken us from Nashville. We went to Mobile, to Bob Armstrong's Bullet. No wonder each new studcast can possibly break another record. No wonder that that's happening. And speaking of another record, the next studcast is number 350. And where will we ride as we get into number 350 next week?
Well, I want to follow up this expansion that we talked about in this studcast. And I want to talk about the plans we had for Birmingham, because it's going to be the largest city that we ever operated in. We were getting ready to open it up, but it was going to be at the end of the year. We're talking about we're in May. We're not going to wrestle in Birmingham until November. So there was so much to do that needed to be done in that market, because they had lost almost all the wrestling fans. It was really dead there. So we were going to do some things to get this first Birmingham show to be a sellout. We wanted not to just have a half a house, which would have been great for what they were doing back in 1980. We wanted to sell it out the very first time we all came and did our deal. So we're going to take a look at what we did to make that happen. And we're also going to look at this really spectacular card for the next week. One of them that I would say really had basically four main events. We have a lot of three main events.
Wow.
This is going to have four main events, and it's going to have one match in it that had never been done before. The first time they'd ever had it.
Wow. Okay. So we got that to look forward to next week on episode number 350. Do not miss it. Hey, folks, you know the deal. If you want to connect with the stud, that is so easy to do. And Ron always responds. If anybody hits him up with comments or sends him a note, that's the cool thing. You can connect with a living legend. Find Ron on Facebook, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a legend. On Twitter or X, he's Ron Fuller Welch. Ron Fuller Welch on X or Twitter. You can follow him there too. Check out the fantastic website at tnstud.com. This studcast will be there with every studcast ever done at tnstud.com. Plus, you can shop the stud store where you get 43 super studcasts, four different 8x10 photos, the thrilling Lion novel Brutus, personally autographed to you, and t-shirts still on sale for only $15.99, all with free shipping. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind. On YouTube, in the search bar, put in Southeastern Rewind. It's the first thing that pops up. Find hundreds of hours of classic old school entertainment. The last 128 studcast, 16 Ask the Stud shows, 115 short rides with the stud, and back 1 year or more, discover fantastic stud stories about worldwide stars, 23 Studcast archive stories, 23 Tell Me More fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and so much more. It's YouTube, Southeastern Rewind, for the best deal in wrestling. You can spend hours on YouTube, Southeastern Rewind. All right, last word is yours, Stud.
Well, I always want to thank everyone, man, who listens to each of these Studcasts. And if you know someone who might enjoy them, please don't hesitate to tell them about us. And take care of yourselves and others. May God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.